Welcome to Leaders and Legends of Online Learning, a podcast dedicated to the experts. Thank you for listening. Each episode, we'll be learning from the world's leading thinkers and practitioners in online learning and linking to ideas relevant to online teaching, working with online learners, and digital education. You can listen to the experts and check their profiles and link to some of their work on our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com. I'm Mark Nichols, the interviewer in this episode. You'll meet Dr. Cathy Kavanagh in this episode. Cathy is a wonderful blend of grounded practice, research-informed innovation, and analytics insight. One standout for me in this interview is Cathy's commentary about the importance of nurturing student community as part of effective online teaching. I'm talking with Dr. Cathy Kavanagh, who is Chief Technology Officer at the Lasting Center for Learning at the University of Florida, following 5 years with Microsoft. Cathy has a research history in K-12 online education and has served in senior higher education positions in Australia, the United Arab Emirates, and the United States. Cathy, it's great to be talking with you.
Thanks so much, Mark. I'm really happy that we could have this conversation.
Brilliant. Thanks, Cathy. Can we start with a brief overview of your career and publications?
Sure. So I've been in education for 38 years at this point. And the way that I got started with online and blended learning was in the 90s. I was leading a center in a primary secondary school district in the U.S. and started producing blended learning experiences for K-12 students using the technology that we had at the time, which was the live TV channel that went into the classrooms and email and fax and phone calls for interaction with experts and people who were sharing over TV. And that experience influenced my doctoral work. And so I began doing research into K-12 online and distance learning because that was the dawn of virtual schooling. There were lots of small kind of online programs for primary and secondary students that were starting. And the question was, do they work, right? That's often the question at the beginning of something. So I did the first meta-analysis of K-12 distance learning and then repeated that a couple of times as technology changed to help to establish a knowledge base around, can students learn effectively using online learning and distance learning? Then as I joined as a faculty member, kind of started my career in academia, I continued the line of research in K-12 distance learning, sort of pivoting to under what conditions does it work well? And so continued that work along and also began developing one of the first online education doctoral programs offered in a research intensive university. So I kind of worked in research and development. And along the way, I was fortunate to lead the research community for the International Association for K-12 Online and Blended Learning, a group called INACOL. And in that group was part of the team that developed the national standards for quality online teaching courses and programs. And moving more recently, I was able to participate in launching a virtual school program in Western Australia. I was part of a team that was leading digital transformation there. And as you know, it's a very, very large territory with many remote communities, and many schools there didn't have access to the courses that students needed to qualify for university. So we started an online program, which has since been recognized and won awards and is doing tremendously well. So I'm really pleased with kind of how things culminated at that stage.
So they would have been fairly early days for the internet, early 2000s, I think.
So yeah, most of that work was in the first sort of 10 years of the 2000s. And then the work in Australia was within the past 5 years.
So yep. What does work well then, Cathy, just based on your research? What did you actually uncover?
Yeah, so as one might expect, it's kind of that combination of having flexible access to content and curriculum so that learning experiences can be tailored for individuals in a way that's manageable by a teacher who's facilitating and you know, motivating many students, combined with that personal touch, you know, the community, the collaboration, the communication. So having learned that kind of a lesson along the way over the early decades of distance learning for K-12, we put that into practice in the Western Australia program and really built it around building strong relationships among teachers and students. And so a lot of the the really successful sort of noteworthy programs have that strong combination where students feel cared for and known as individuals, and they've got the flexibility of learning in times and places that work for them with curriculum that lets them learn in ways that that are relevant and meaningful.
Fantastic. Now, Kathy, there's very many different ways of offering online education, and you mentioned the flexibility, which would imply an asynchronous approach. How do you actually get those strong relationships happening? What were the mechanisms you were using in the pedagogy to facilitate that?
Yeah. So, yeah, talking about synchronous and asynchronous first, one of the things that the group in Microsoft where I was working, we noticed in the early days of the COVID-19 response was that many school systems started out in a way that was familiar to them. They wanted to replicate the classroom experience and do synchronous learning, live learning, essentially all day, just a series of lessons. And that quickly became exhausting and overwhelming. And so kind of the pendulum swung in the opposite direction. And they tried completely asynchronous so that everyone would have that complete flexibility. And then as one might predict, isolation set in and people felt disconnected. And so, you know, just through trial and error, very quick trial and error, ended up back in that center place where there's a balance of synchronous and asynchronous, which there's no one perfect formula because, you know, if we think about the range of learners from primary through secondary and different teaching styles and the demands of content in different areas, the blend will look a little bit different. But having some time, whether it's sometime during the day or sometime during the week, to learn independently, but with access to support as needed, and periodic live connected sessions seems to be the right balance. You know, teachers bringing whole groups together to build that community, that's where those relationships happen. You know, speaking to each other, seeing their faces, learning about each other, seeing each other as humans, and then being able to sort of chat and have digital conversations in between where people feel trusted, they respect each other, and they can be who they are in a safe environment, builds the community of learning.
Absolutely. So, Kathy, you've had some fairly interesting years at Microsoft, including time working with analytics. So you've mentioned something that you discovered during the time of COVID. What are some other stories that data would tell us?
Oh, yeah. So we had what we called our support website for primary secondary educators using technology. It's a global site. It offered in many languages with articles and video and other kinds of content to help educators to get answers to their questions and use the tools within the education context specifically. And so we looked at the data of how educators were using that site. What were they searching for before and then after schools went online? What were they using? How did their patterns of what they were seeking and what they were doing, how did that change? And that gave us some interesting insights as to what their needs were in the first probably 8 weeks of the COVID situation. And so we probably could have predicted it if we had stopped to do that, but we didn't. So we kind of looked at it retrospectively. So what they were looking for were video, like very quick video to show them something. And, you know, thinking about that, in a normal time, they might have gone down the hall or taken a workshop to have someone, an expert, or someone with experience show them the thing that they were learning to do, but they looked for video. So use of video multiplied by about 40 times what it was previously. They were also looking for the how-tos situated specifically in digital pedagogy. So whereas previously they might've been looking for very specific skills like how do I do live PowerPoint, or you know, how do I help students learn to write using word processing. It would have been broad, general kinds of approaches. It narrowed down dramatically to how do I manage communication? How do I manage meetings? How do I provide content? How do I make sure that what I'm doing is inclusive and I'm accounting for accessibility? So it became very, very sort of specific and immediate. So that led us to begin creating content for educators in some very different ways to make sure that we were kind of trying to stay ahead of them and help them to have continuity with what they were doing, which was entirely new.
Makes sense. So the professional development that you offered and developed was in direct response to the analytic searches that you noticed through the website.
Exactly. Yep.
Brilliant. Kathy, you've had some really interesting exposure across both the K-12 and the higher education sector. What are some of the challenges that are similar and different across both of those for online education?
So when I was working previously at university level, students were still kind of looking for programs and credentials. They wanted something kind of deep and sustained that would help them to move forward in their careers. K-12 students kind of are doing what you know what they're told they need to do, but whereas adults have a little bit more kind of autonomy. And so we needed to be sensitive in higher education to the marketplace. You know, what were the options? What were the choices that students had? And so in the particular doctoral program that we developed, we wanted it to be flexible for working adults who wanted to have that kind of culminating degree, but wanted to continue doing what they were doing. But we also wanted to make sure that we were developing community. So we had some short couple of weeks summer sessions on the campus to help with that community aspect. And we started with those to make sure that people knew each other before then they spread back out and were working through courses, you know, online and asynchronously. So the blends look different between synchronous and asynchronous, and kind of the empathy that's needed to identify with where people are and their context and what their needs are is slightly different. But I think just the main commonality is the need for community, the need for groups of people who know each other and will look after each other, that doesn't change.
Okay, so the community is obviously quite central into the model. Is it always necessary or is it always possible to have that face-to-face contact at the very start? Are you experienced in models where that doesn't take place, but community is still developed?
Yep. Yes. I think it definitely helps. It definitely helps to see people in three dimensions. I think we've learned that over the past 100 days or so. But you're right. It's not always possible. It's not always practical. And so kind of going to the next best thing, which would be using video periodically to see each other and maybe, you know, share something about themselves that's outside of the academic realm so that we can at least think about each other in three dimensions.
Excellent. So video, some self-disclosure. I'd imagine that would have been quite useful in the Western Australia example.
Exactly. Yep. One of the first things that those educators did was to share something about themselves and ask students to share something about themselves, you know, to the extent that everyone was comfortable. And then they, you know, the teachers made sure to refer to those and to ask about students and ask about their families and, you know, just show kind of model caring behavior along the way. So it didn't feel like it was, you know, kind of a business or academic transaction all the time. It was those conversations that you might have in the hallway at a school or in, you know, out in the playground. They need to look different when they're online. And so that's why that community and relationship piece was embedded into the professional development for educators in that program explicitly.
Great. So Kathy, you've very recently, in fact, you mentioned today, you've started as Chief Technology Officer with the University of Florida. So
that's right.
I imagine that role also has some pedagogical responsibilities.
It does. Yep. It does. So the center produces digital learning experiences for students and educators. And it focuses on three sort of key horizons in a child's education that make the most substantial difference in academic and life outcomes, which are readiness for school, early learning, and then literacy and foundational math skills. And so there's technology that's developed based on research with researchers, informed by research along the way, where students can learn math in an online environment, but supported by expert tutors and facilitators, and where educators can earn credentials in early learning and learn the newest and most effective approaches to literacy, also in an online setting designed specifically for professional learning within a professional learning community. So yeah, a lot of what I've learned along the way feeds into the work that's coming up today.
It sounds like an incredibly rich context there. Are you able to describe that model? So what would it look like from a student perspective? What would a typical study pattern look like?
Yeah. So in the math program, they're called Math Nation and Algebra Nation. Students have sequences of video and learning experiences based on kind of building skills within mathematics concepts. Part of the research has been looking at, should those sequences be the same for every student, or should they be adjusted based on past performance? And so part of the research is kind of making adjustments and refinements to what those sequences look like. But then along the way, as students need help, or as their performance indicates that they could be supported, those expert tutors are available and have sessions with the students. And they're recorded and they're face-to-face, so the students can see each other and get to know those tutors. And those tutors are often university students or kind of new in career, so they're not very different in age from the secondary students who are learning math, but they're very highly trained as tutors and facilitators. So they're there to support the students and kind of keep them motivated and help them to move forward. And it's made significant differences for students who are using that program to learn math.
Fantastic. Kathy, I'm going to put you on the spot here a little bit. So this is mm-hmm. a distance approach. Do you think mm-hmm. it's actually better than the face-to-face tuition these students might receive otherwise?
That's the exact question that that the research is looking to answer. You know, it's John Dewey's question about, is there a better way than an individual face-to-face tutor? And the answer will be different for different individuals, but we've struggled in humanity to provide individual tutors per person who's learning everything along their journey. So we need to do something that's effective, but also feasible and scalable. And so, you know, this approach is working, but no approach is perfect. There are always opportunities to continue to improve it. And that's what we do through research.
Yeah, fair response. Education truly is something quite wicked. There's always a better way to do something.
It is. Exactly.
At least what you're describing is scalable and also very flexible. So I'd imagine these students can also work to some extent asynchronously on their own timetable.
Exactly. That's correct. Yep.
Great. So even though it may not be one-to-one face-to-face, there are other benefits mm-hmm. around this model that couldn't otherwise be realized.
That's right. And, you know, one of the issues, especially in the U.S., and I imagine in other places, qualified mathematics teachers are in short supply. Mm. And so having an approach that helps students to continue learning or accelerate their learning in math, despite the availability of a teacher who can help them, is incredibly important. And the system is also used for professional development. So teachers can go in and learn the same skills and learn the pedagogies as well. So it's looking to kind of attack that problem at the same time.
Mm, excellent. So it's a really good example of online learning actually benefiting much more broadly than just replacing the classroom. There are other opportunities here.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's it.
So, Kathy, I know you are active in this research. Is there any other research that you would most like to see related to online education?
Yeah, I think there's a need to bring together research that's happening in social emotional learning and well-being in general in education and the online space, and better understand how data, big data, and advanced analytics can help us. So essentially, what I think is that research in online learning needs to be more comprehensive, needs to account for a wider range of data, qualitative and quantitative, to get a richer, a more complete view of the learning experience, and think in broader ways about how data can be used around you know, what students are doing, and to understand how we can better support them.
Mm, now, there is some emerging literature on that, isn't it? Can you tell us a bit about that? You must have done some background reading on this. Well, what are some of the themes that are coming through? What are some promising sounding approaches?
Yeah, so I'll refer to some work out of the time at Microsoft with a school district in the U.S., which is very diverse, has high levels of poverty. It's called Fresno School District in California. And they've been about 5 years on their journey, and they measure social emotional learning along with the academic skills, the kind of core academic skills that most school systems will be measuring. And they collected data around how educators and students were using the digital content and the communication and collaboration tools that they had in their personalized learning approach, and looked at exactly what we're talking about, looked at what those patterns of use look like. So, for example, a teacher who adapts the content in the curriculum, students tend to perform better. Students who use a combination of tools, including formative assessment tools and digital content and their collaboration tools, tended to do better on both academic and social emotional measures. So the kinds of things that we've been talking about around community tend to benefit students both academically and in terms of their social emotional learning. So, that combination of the human approach and the flexible learning tend to have broad benefits that we're just really beginning to understand.
Yeah, I'm curious about the observation about social emotional well-being measured qualitatively as well as quantitatively. How can we actually establish a student's state of mind or emotional well-being based on their analytics?
Yeah, so there are those sort of post hoc measures and kind of questions that students can be asked. But there are also ways to kind of indicate their affect along the way and get kind of quick random indicators of how students are feeling. And so, we see kind of the mood meters that are used in some schools, indicators of how students are feeling. And when those questions about how students are feeling are randomly included during their learning experience, then we get a better picture of, not just skills that they're developing, but also kind of how they're approaching the experience that they're having. Is there anxiety or stress? Are they feeling sort of satisfied and calm? And what are the conditions around that feeling? And how can we optimize for the sort of calm and satisfied feeling, or even excited and motivated feeling, and try to reduce those stressed and anxious feelings? So there's some research happening there. And, I think it's kind of always been the case in education where we do little pockets of research and then we start to bring them together and tie the pieces together and get the bigger picture. And I feel that we're close to that point, or at that point, where we should be doing that in online learning.
Mm, fantastic. And is this the sort of research you'll be working on in your new role?
Yes. Yep. Definitely.
Yeah, Kathy, online education has been debated for quite some time as not being as good as the traditional alternative. Typically, online learning makes strides when it's a necessity, not so much the preference. Do you think that's changing, especially now post-COVID?
Yep, I do. So I kind of think back to some of the conversations that I had with INACOL, the International Association for K-12 Online Learning. There were always student perspectives included in conferences and in the work that group was doing. And so many students told stories of choosing online learning because the face-to-face experience of school wasn't working for them. In some cases, it was academic. They might have had specific learning difficulties that were better suited when they had the flexibility or the structure of the online environment. But in many cases, it was the social environment of the school. And so, we kind of stepped back and thought, is the best way to learn to be in a building with thousands of teenagers? Maybe, maybe not. We always hear, unfortunately, about students who are bullied and have other social challenges within school. When they stepped out of that physical space into the virtual space, uniformly, what they said was they were no longer judged by their appearance. They were judged by their words and their performance, because that's what's visible in the online environment. And the students said the same thing in the program in Western Australia. They might have been outliers in their school, but in the digital class, they were in a community of people more like them, and they were known by what they said and what they did in that community, rather than being judged superficially. And so I think that there are families and students who are choosing online programs as an alternative. And of course, there are those who experience them as a necessity because there are no alternatives. But we go back to, there are many ways of experiencing something. There are many ways of being successful with something, because we're dealing with individuals. And so, I think with adults as well as primary and secondary students, there are many benefits depending on who someone is and what their needs are.
Mm, absolutely. I'm reminded too, of course, that the K-12 sector is a compulsory sector, isn't it? So these will be full-time students. So the community element is that much more important. But it's fantastic to hear that it had such a positive influence on student success. Mm. So, Kathy, you've been active in online distance education now for many years, so there will be people who have influenced you. Who are two people you'd recommend as perhaps legends of online learning, one whose work or perspective is significantly influencing you now, and one who you think otherwise might have an important perspective to share?
Yeah, one of the first people that I thought of was Dr. Susan Lowes, who recently retired from Teachers College at Columbia University. And in the early days of online learning, primary and secondary, she looked at how educators were developing the skills, their online pedagogies, and when they were teaching part-time online and part-time in their classroom, or they were teaching online and then went back into the physical classroom, what seemed to be the influence of learning to teach online and actually teaching online in classroom experience. And what she found was that educators changed their practice. And I think this is relevant right now in the era of COVID, as educators are teaching remotely or in a hybrid or blended situation. But at some point, we were optimistic they will return to their face-to-face classrooms. What could be the impact? And so she found that, yes, they changed their practices, and they were also assessed or observed by, you know, the school leaders to be better teachers in some ways. And they themselves felt that way as well. They were more organized and structured. They understood what individual students needed from a different perspective because they had done kind of individualized support and tutoring for students. And so she's got a range of publications from that work. And I think revisiting that now will be very informative. So she's one.
Excellent.
A second one is one of the pioneers of K-12 online learning, who's still very active, and that's Julie Young. She was one of the principals who started Florida Virtual School, one of the first and often largest virtual schools. And now she works at Arizona State University's online high school, which is a unique situation, having an online high school within a university that not only does research in online learning, but does a lot of adult online learning. So there's a different access to expertise, resources, and data in a situation like that. And she's just continued to lead the way and think sort of at the horizon on online learning. And I don't know if I can recommend one more, but I would recommend Meredith Rowe. Meredith Rowe leads the program in Western Australia. And, she's a great thinker around what students need, because she's with them all the time and trying new things like digital camps and transition programs for students who are first starting boarding school. And how can online learning help students who are deaf and hard of hearing? So I think she's definitely worth speaking with.
Brilliant. Kathy, it's been a fantastic interview. I've learned a lot about you and your work. Thank you for the inspirational work you're doing. And thank you, too, for being a leader and legend of online learning.
I appreciate the opportunity. Your insightful questions, you've made it a delight to have the conversation.
Thanks, Kathy.
You can learn more about Kathy and her work from our website. That concludes this episode. Be sure to go to our website, www.onlinelearninglegends.com, to follow up on this episode's guest. You'll also find links to others whose ideas continue to inspire and teach online learning professionals, and you can subscribe to future interviews. If you know of a leader or legend we've not yet talked to, please do drop us a line at onlinelearninglegends@gmail.com.